This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, two stories of what in the modern world we've come to call apartheid, the practice of segregating a subjugated population and imposing oppressive laws on it. First, we talk with UK historian Harry Friedman about his captivating history of the first Jewish ghetto, that of Venice, Italy. It's called Shylock's Venice. Then we revisit my conversation with novelist Rebecca Sachs about her powerful novel, City of a Thousand Gates. Its depiction of Israeli apartheid against the citizens of the occupied West Bank resonates with the apartheid against Jews in Venice during medieval and Renaissance times. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Millions flock to Venice each year, often unaware of an important part of the past that shapes the city. Central to this history is the Jewish ghetto, the birthplace of the term ghetto itself. In his book, Shylock's Venice, Harry Friedman masterfully recounts the evolution of Venice's ghetto from its creation in 1516 to its ending under Napoleon in 1797. The ghetto was not just a place of confinement. It was also a vibrant epicenter of cultural and intellectual flourishing. Despite its physical barriers, the Venice ghetto walls became permeable to the exchange of ideas as Jews and Christians mingled and advanced together into modernity. The tale of Venice's Jews is incomplete without addressing Shakespeare's notorious character, Shylock. Harry Friedman reveals how Shakespeare's portrayal of Shylock was influenced by Elizabethan antisemitism, but also transcended it to reflect on the common humanity that Venice's ghetto exemplified as a meeting place of peoples of diverse faiths. Harry Friedman is the author of popular works of Jewish culture and history, including works about the Kabbalah, the Talmud, and the history of Britain's Jews. Harry Friedman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Francesca, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be talking to you this evening.
This is such an interesting book, Shylock's Venice. Venice was the first ghetto for Jews in the world. And before we talk any further about Venice, which I will ask you about Venice and what it was like. But first, describe to us what the Venice ghetto was like and what it was like to live there.
So the Venice ghetto is founded, established in 1516. The reason they established it was because for centuries prior to that, Jews were not allowed into Venice, but at the same time, the only trades they could practice was money lending and pawnbroking. And so people would try to borrow money, you know, small amounts of money to tide them over for a few days. They would have to travel across the lagoon from the city of Venice to the mainland to find a pawnbroker. The Jews came into the city when there was a war. They fled into the city, and the Venetians realized how much more convenient it would be to keep them there. But at the same time, they didn't want Jews in the city. The church particularly was not very pleased about the fact that Jews were in the city. And so the compromise was to keep them in the city, but to confine them to a single area. And they put them in the area we now know as the Venice Ghetto, which is right on the northern edge of the city, so you know, quite a long way away from the central, the Rialto, the markets where things were happening. The area they chose was a former copper foundry. In those days, it was a square of four houses with a field in between, a field about the size, I suppose, of a football pitch, something like that. Nothing, you know, not a huge field, but it was really four houses surrounding a field. And it was very, very muddy and unsanitary. There was no paving. The field was muddy. This is Venice. We're talking about Venice, so it's wet ground anyway. and there's no drainage, there's no sewerage, there's nothing like that. So it was really squalid. And because the Jews were confined in this area, they couldn't spread out laterally. When more people moved in, they couldn't build war houses outside the ghetto. They could only build up. And so what happened was that you ended up with these very, very tall, narrow buildings with as many rooms crammed into them as possible, so low ceilings, fragile walls to minimize the load on the ground, and it really was quite an unpleasant place to live.
On the other hand, it was a place that saw an incredible renaissance of Jewish thought and thinking. You talk about a Jewish enlightenment. What made the ghetto special in a positive sense? What were some of the circumstances that allowed this enlightenment to flourish?
So we're talking now about a period at the end of the Renaissance, the great reawakening of art and culture, particularly in Italy. And whereas in Florence, the Renaissance was very much about arts and music, in Venice, it was much more about words and ideas and philosophies. And so what you had in the Venice ghetto was really two influences. One was the fact that there were Venice anyway, not just the ghetto, Venice anyway, had a number of scholars of mysticism, of Kabbalah, Christian and Jewish Kabbalah, philosophers in the city. The fact you've got a large number of people confined into a very small space, and really, you know, creative, intelligent people, meant that the the ghetto was a venue where ideas circulated rapidly and caught on. And at the same time, Venice is the only place in Europe at that stage which has a license to print Hebrew books. The printer who obtained a license, Daniel Bomberg, a Christian printer, but he got a license to print Hebrew books. And because we're at the dawn of printing, dozens of scholars, people who had written manuscripts of Hebrew books, poetry or philosophy or religion or whatever, would come to Venice to get their books printed in Bomberg's print shop. And so therefore, Venice becomes not just a place where people are talking to each other about high ideas, but also a place where scholars are arriving to get their books printed. And the combination of those two things means that you ended up with a number of really interesting and intelligent people who are basically raised the intellectual level of the ghetto.
And we will get back to some of those people as we talk a little bit more. You call this Shylock's Venice. Say a little bit about Shylock and his image. How did he come about? What does he represent? How does he represent what is same or different about attitudes towards Jews at that time?
Okay, so Shylock. First of all, the main thing about Shylock, of course, is that he is Shakespeare's invention. And so therefore, when we talk about Shylock, what we're really talking about is Shakespeare's image, Shakespeare's understanding of Jews and how Jews lived in Venice in those days. And to understand that, we have to first of all appreciate that Shakespeare lives at a time where officially Jews are banned from England. There are Jews, but they tend to be Jews who converted to Christianity. They were forced to convert in Spain and Portugal at the end of the 15th century. There are a number of those people living in England, but Shakespeare knows no Jews as such. And therefore, he has this rather romanticized or perhaps villainized view of Jews, depending on how you look at the character of Shylock. And he's using Shylock in a number of different ways, really. And this is one of the great mysteries of The Merchant of Venice, is Shylock a villain? Is Shylock a sympathetic character? What does Shakespeare really think of Shylock? And we have these two very contradictory views. You have the idea of the man who wants the pound of flesh, the usurer who demands me to strict justice, and you have the man who makes this impassioned speech about, if you prick me, do I not bleed? If you tickle me, do I not laugh? So, you know, how do we understand Shylock? Shakespeare places Shylock in a house in Venice which doesn't seem to be a house in the ghetto. It's too opulent. He's too wealthy. The Jews in the ghetto were just not like that. So that either means that Shakespeare had no concept of the ghetto, or possibly that he knew about the ghetto but was placing Shylock at a different historical period, which is also difficult because of other allusions in the play. So if we come back to the idea that Shakespeare has no concept of the ghetto, we then have to ask why the English ambassador to Venice is a man called Henry Wotton, and Henry Wotton has friends in Shakespeare's company in England, and Henry Wotton corresponds with learns with a Venetian rabbi called Leon de Modena, and Leon de Modena corresponds with people in England who know about Shakespeare's company, who know about Shakespeare's Globe Theatre. So the idea that Shakespeare is ignorant of the ghetto is quite strange. So we end up really with no answers, just a lot of questions. What is Shakespeare trying to do? And what I'm trying to argue in the book, and it's not my argument, it's an argument which came together from a very renowned scholar called Dame Frances Yates, who died 15, 20 years ago, is that Shylock is a metaphor. Shylock is a metaphor for the occult ideas circulating in those days, based on Kabbalah, based on various other occult traits, which is that Shylock represents the attribute, if you like, of justice, whereas Antonio, the man who owes him money, represents the attribute of love. And Portia, who is the judge who tries to resolve the dilemma, represents the attribute of mercy, which harmonizes between love and justice. So this is all very complicated. I don't think we should go into too much detail. But the basic point is that Shakespeare, I think, is using Shylock allegorically rather than trying to describe the life of a Jew in Venice.
So Shylock, the rich moneylender who did not live in the ghetto, was not actually typical of Jewish moneylenders.
So absolutely not. I mean, so the image, if you like, the historical image of Jewish moneylenders is wealthy bankers who are lending money to dukes and barons and kings to finance their wars or to finance their territorial expansion. There were a handful of those throughout history, but the vast majority of Jewish moneylenders are pawnbrokers, and they really are lending a few coins in exchange for rags so that poor people can get through the week until they next get paid. This is one of the problems with the presentation of Jews in history. The word moneylender brings to our minds a wealthy person, and that's certainly how Shylock is portrayed by Shakespeare. But the vast majority of Jewish so-called moneylenders were actually pawnbrokers, and they were as impoverished, really, as the people that they were lending money to. They were impoverished because the Venetians set very high interest rates. They had to lend at high rates. The Venetians took a huge amount of tax from them out of their profits. The Jews anyway had to pay a tax. They had a charter which was renewed every 5 years, under which they had to pay a tax for the privilege of living in the ghetto. So poverty was rife. There are no rich Jews in the ghetto, and Shylock certainly is not a rich ghetto Jew.
And so talk about the role of these Jewish pawnbrokers, basically, of the Jews themselves in Venice. Money lending of this kind was virtually the only profession open to them. What role do they play in the larger governance of Venice and the social kind of keeping the social peace in Venice?
Okay, so first of all, just to clarify, Jews are not just in Italy, but across Europe, Jews are excluded from the trades and the guilds. The guilds were the bodies which controlled the various trades, printing or whatever. And in order to carry out a trade, you had to be a member of a guild, and Jews were not allowed to join the guilds. They were not allowed to own land. They were not allowed to practice any profession, with the exception of medicine. So the Jews in the ghetto were either moneylenders or pawnbrokers, I should say, or they were support people, if you like, bakers and butchers and people like that who are supplying the needs of the community in the ghetto, or they were doctors. And it's only really the doctors who have any significant impact on the life of Venice outside the ghetto, because the doctors, there is a tradition in the Jewish social world of studying medicine. Many of the leading doctors in Venice were Jews, and many of the leading aristocracy of Venice had Jewish doctors, were patients of Jewish doctors. So the doctors have some sort of influence, but they're not involved in governance. Venice is an autocracy. It's run by a small number of very wealthy families. Even the ordinary people of Venice have very little say in the way things are run there, and the Jews certainly don't. The Jews have, they're self-governing within their community, but they have no governance impact outside of their community.
And yet, you point out that Venice was a republic, and in that way it was quite different from the rest of Europe. Talk about that contrast and what it meant in terms of the governance of that republic itself, the Council of Ten.
When we talk about Venice as a republic, we're not talking about a place like the United States where you have a president and a democracy and a Congress and elected representatives. You're talking about a place which has a Senate comprised of about 2,000 people. It varies from time to time. There are about 2,000 people who are the wealthy aristocrats within the city. And they elect or choose, choose is probably a better word than elect, they choose various committees. And they have a sort of a hierarchy. The Doges, or the Doge, which is the Italian word for Duke, is at the top of the hierarchy, although he's really a figurehead. He doesn't have much power. And then there are various committees beneath him. And the Council of Ten is the equivalent, I suppose, of the cabinet in a modern democracy. They're the executive body. They're the body who make the day-to-day decisions, but ultimately they're answerable to the Senate and to the Doge. So we can't really look at Venice through modern eyes. We can only look at it as a republic in as much as it doesn't have a king. The Doge is somebody who was appointed by the Senate, and he has that job usually for life unless he's been deposed. But he's not a king. There is no hereditary right of his family to rule after him.
And so now you say in this book, Harry Friedman and Shylock's Venice, that the fact that the ghetto was a separate, geologically defined Jewish space radically reshaped the way Jews thought about themselves and their relationship with their Christian neighbors. I'd like you to talk about that and also talk about the example of Don Isaac Abarbanel. Is this an example of what you were talking about and his relationship with the Council of Ten?
So Don Isaac Abarbanel arrives in Venice before the ghetto is founded. He's been expelled from Spain together with all the other Jews in 1492. He's a very wealthy man, a very successful man. He's been a diplomat in the King of Spain's court. He's a doctor. He's a scholar. He writes books of commentary on the Bible. Very wealthy, very well-respected man. He's stayed in various places in Italy after being expelled from Spain, and he arrives in Venice around 1498, 1499, something like that. He's not in the ghetto. He turns up in Venice offering the Council of Ten a solution to an economic problem they have. The problem they have is that Venice, for centuries, has controlled the trade in the Mediterranean, the trade bringing spices and goods from the east, from India and China, across the Arabian Desert to Turkey, where it was loaded onto ships and transported by merchants to Venice and other ports in Europe. And Venice was the place which dominated that trade. But a few years earlier, Vasco da Gama, the Portuguese mariner, has sailed around the bottom of Africa and found a sea route to India. And the sea route to India means that traders no longer needed to bring their goods across the difficult and long journey across the Arabian Desert. They could load them onto a boat in India and ship them by boat all the way to Portugal. And that effectively cut Venice out of the trade. Now, Don Isaac Abarbanel, after being expelled from Spain before arriving in Italy, has lived in Portugal. He's been expelled from there as well, but he knows how things work in Portugal. He's a wealthy man. He knows the Portuguese royal court. He can pull strings in Portugal. So he goes to the Senate and he comes up with a proposal to help them to do a deal, if you like, with Portugal to regain some of their trade. And I've forgotten the rest of your question.
Oh, yeah. When you say that the fact that the ghetto was a separate geologically defined Jewish space radically reshaped the way Jews thought about themselves and their relationship with their Christian neighbors, What do you mean?
Well, what that means is that up to now, across Europe, Jews have been a shunned and a separate people. They've lived in Christian communities, in villages and towns where there's been a Christian minority. They've been persecuted. They've been expelled. They've been moved around. All sorts of terrible things have happened to them. They've never been self-governing, even if it's only self-governing within the confines of the ghetto. The ghetto gives them a certain amount of self-respect, a certain amount of self-identity, if you like. We are now a group of people who have the ability to set our own rules, to raise our own taxes from our own people, to tell people how they should dress, how they should behave, to get involved when there are disputes and things like that. So it gives them a sense of identity, if you like. At the same time, because the economic model is that the money coming into the ghetto is coming in from Venetian citizens, Christians who are coming into the ghetto to initially just to pawn their goods, but eventually for more than that, because the ghetto becomes an interesting place where people come in there to watch plays or to listen to music or to converse with scholars. You get a sort of a dialogue establishing itself between the Venetian citizenry and the ghetto population. And so you have these two different groups of people, each of whom has their own sense of who they are, interacting. And one of the things we find is that the Jews in the ghetto, who initially would have spoken Yiddish or Spanish because they'd come either from Northern Europe or from Spain via Turkey, are now talking in Italian. And the Jews in Venice, for the first time in Jewish history, are writing books in Italian for Italian readers. And this is what I mean by a renaissance. The Jews are, and it's counterintuitive, by the very fact that they're confined and separated from everybody else, they're actually able to engage more with everybody else, because they now recognize there is an other out there who they can communicate with and understand, and they can communicate with them in their own language. So you get people like Simone Luzzatto or Don Isaac Abravanel's son, Leone Obreo, who are writing philosophy books in Italian, writing books of politics in Italian, not for the Jews of the ghetto, but for the Italians of Venice and elsewhere. And this is the first time, really, that Jews have engaged in society outside their own walls.
And there's so many fascinating personalities that you write about in this book, Harry Friedman, in Shylock's Venice. One of them that I was so interested in was Judah Leon. Tell us about him and the cultural revolution that he ushered in, and his idea of love, which I completely agree with.
So this is Leone Ebreo. This is Don Isaac Abravanel's son. And he writes a book. It's a book of philosophy, but the story of the book is he makes it a dialogue between two people. One is called Philo, which of course is Greek for love, and one is called Sophia, Sophie, which is wisdom. And it's a dialogue between love and wisdom, or love and philosophy. And what he's trying to do is to show, if you like, that the world revolves around love, and that true wisdom is an understanding of love. And this is his philosophy. So he's Platonic. He's drawing on Plato's ideas, but he's casting them in a very modern way for the 16th century. And he's getting across these ideas that love is the key to the universe, if you like, and that true wisdom is the understanding of love.
That is a philosophy all of us could use so much more in this time.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. Yeah. We could do with someone like him now.
You mentioned Kabbalah before. You say that the Kabbalah as a field of study was in a prime place in Venice. It was really dominant. Tell us, what is Kabbalism and what role did it play in the Venice ghetto?
So Kabbalah is the Jewish mystical approach, the idea that one can understand how the universe, the spirituality of the universe works, how God acts on the world. It's been around for a long time. It became very popular, not just in Venice, it became very popular, particularly in Florence during the Renaissance. Christian scholars believe that by harnessing the techniques and the tools of the scholars, which are basically meditation techniques and techniques of playing with words and numbers and combining letters to create new words and symbols, by doing this, they could communicate with the angels, and that would give them a better understanding of the spiritual universe, if you like. And so there grew up a movement, if you like, called Christian Kabbalah, focused on Florence, but with, you know, a lot of practitioners in Venice. And those Christian practitioners of Kabbalah in Venice were talking to the Jewish practitioners of Kabbalah. It's the same system with obviously a slightly different approach, but the idea is the same. And you have a scholarship going on, an exchange of ideas between these two groups of people, which, again, is part of the wonderful nature of the Venice ghetto, that you have these two different communities talking to each other about things which unite them rather than divide them.
How ultimately did the ghetto in Venice end?
So the ghetto in Venice ends in 1797, when Napoleon, who's rampaging through Europe, conquers Venice and tears down the ghetto gates and tells the Jews they can live freely as free citizens. This is part of Napoleon's philosophy, is that everybody has equal rights. It doesn't last long, because Napoleon, his main opponent during the war, is against the Austrians, and eventually he has to reach a compromise with the Austrians, which includes him handing Venice over to Austria, and Austria tell the Jews they can't leave the ghetto. They don't rebuild the gates and the walls that Napoleon has torn down, but the Jews are still confined to the ghetto. And what happens is that the Jews are now semi-free, and as free as Jews are anywhere else in the Austrian Empire. They're living in the ghetto because that's where they've been told to live, but they can move around freely within the city. And they stay like that for until now, really. I mean, the Jews no longer live in the ghetto, but because that's where the synagogues were, and because that's where the schools were, the ghetto remains the heart of the Jewish community, even though the few Jews who live in Venice today tend not to live in the ghetto. And of course, it was destroyed. The people were destroyed by the Nazis during the Holocaust. There's a very moving story there about a man called Giuseppe Giona, who was the leader of the Jewish community. The Nazis came to him and they said they wanted the names of every Jew in the ghetto, and he had 3 days to give it to them. And he spent those 3 days destroying every single document he could find, tearing everything up so there were no records at all, so the Nazis couldn't identify anybody. And then when he'd done that, he committed suicide. And he's now regarded in Venice as one of the heroes of the resistance. But it's a very sad end to the story.
Well, it is just a fascinating book, Harry Friedman. Your book is Shylock's Venice. It is a wonderful picture into a time at the birth of the modern world, really. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Francesca, thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and it's been a delight. Thank you so much indeed.
Shylock's Venice, The Remarkable History of Venice's Jews and the Ghetto, is out from Bloomsbury Press. Next up, a novel about Israel and the occupied West Bank. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Briannan. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content and listen again for free, either there or on your favorite podcast app. The Israeli genocide in Gaza was more than 3 years in the future when I interviewed Rebecca Sachs about her powerful novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It's about the intersecting stories of the peoples of Israel and Palestine and how oppression twists and informs the humanity of perpetrators and victims. Here's our conversation. Rebecca Sachs' searing and powerfully written debut novel, City of a Thousand Gates, interweaves the stories of a cast of characters, Palestinians, Israelis, and observers, in Israel and the occupied West Bank. It's a place where violence is routine and survival is defined by boundaries, walls, and checkpoints that force people to live and love within and across them. The novel revolves around two interconnected and defining events, the murders of two teens. One is Yael, an Israeli settler murdered in her bed at night. Soon after, a revenge killing of Salem, a Palestinian teenager who's beaten to death by a gang of Israeli men at a mall. Vera, a German journalist, is witness to the impact of the murders on the society and people around her. Rebecca Sachs fully enters into the personalities of her characters, never shrinking from the moral challenges of a society where injustice and privilege play out. Rebecca Sachs has received several writing awards and is a citizen of Canada, the United States, and Israel. Her dispatches from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem have been published in journals such as the Paris Review Daily. Rebecca Sachs, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
This novel, City of a Thousand Gates, is a searing exploration of life across the Israeli-Palestinian divide through the intersecting lives of a range of characters, 32 in all, with 19 of them having a voice. First, I just want to ask you, how were you able, as a non-Israeli, non-Palestinian, to get this so right?
Thank you. I should say that although I went to Israel initially as someone who wasn't Israeli and didn't speak Hebrew, I did eventually take citizenship, which is very easy if you have Jewish heritage, and essentially impossible if you do not. But still, I'll always be an outsider there. And that does have its advantages, I think. If you're going to write about a place, to have access and yet also to not be eligible for a full sense of belonging. But in terms of how I wrote characters very far outside of myself, for me, I think it started almost always deep inside the character. I had to find an entry point with each character, maybe something we shared, and go from there. And by go from there, I mean go deep into this other character and leave myself behind. But it did need for me to start with an entry point into the interior life of the character. What I didn't want was for the characters to read like ambassadors for their identity, or to be almost performing their identity for a reader. So I needed to find a way to get deep inside. And it really varied with character. For example, the woman Samar, she's a middle-aged Palestinian academic. So we, based on that, have almost nothing in common. However, she feels very torn between what she feels as the imperative of her own work, her own research, and her obligations to her family. And she has a kind of conflicted relationship with her memories of her mother and how to match up those memories with the person that she knows now as her mother, who is aging and has in so many ways softened. And I think a lot of what I've just described, a lot of these tensions and this relationship to memory and family, these are very much things that I share and concerns I share. So if I could start from, no matter how much of a sliver it was, the little places where our Venn diagrams overlapped, if I could start there, then I could wade away from myself into the character and sort of let go of myself and enter their world and their sensibility and their concerns more fully. And I know for me, perhaps I imagine for other fiction writers too, that is what I seek after, my own disappearance into someone else.
And you do it magnificently. I should say this is a kind of a point of view. I mean, even when it's written in the third person, it's really written in the first person, and a very close kind of first person.
Yes, yes. It's a very, very, very close third. Yes, it's interesting. I actually find with a close third, as I've written in, you can get closer, actually, than with an I. The I, for me, always, the pronoun I has a hard shell. And I'm working on something new now, and I'm writing in an I, and it's interesting how resistant that I is. But with a close third, you, the writer, are giving yourself permission to see things about the character that maybe the character is unwilling to see about themselves, or could see, but only for an instant. For example, the young mother, Emily, who at times feels a tremendous hostility towards her newborn, that sort of surfaces in her and she sees it and then almost immediately forgets about it, because how could you hold that thought in your conscious mind for too long? And so I think with a close third, it's actually, you have more of the characters, more of the sort of the darker corners of a character's internal world available to you than you do, or at least this is how I feel with an I. But yeah, so I've heard the pronouns in terms of whether it's third or first don't matter, except to the writer. But I think for me, they make a huge difference in terms of what I feel is available to me as the writer in relation to whoever's point of view we're in.
Yeah, and I think you really made a point that I've never thought of before, and that is, you know, that it actually gives you more freedom to be closer to a character, to have this close third. And speaking of that, I think we should let our listeners in on, you know, the central fact at the heart of this book, which is two murders, the killing of an Israeli teenager, a young girl named Yael, and a Palestinian boy. They're both 14. His name is Salem. Tell us about those two murders and why you made this the heart of the book.
Yes. Actually, both of those two murders started as a kind of, there's a lot of violence that, there's the constant threat of violence or the constant reality of violence. And I think for a lot of the book, it's animating it as a kind of hum. There's a character, Miriam, who at one point notices that there's this sort of electric buzz all around her settlement. And she's not sure if it's the fence they put up for security or the power lines or something else. And I think violence is that kind of that buzz, always there till it becomes a constant, a given, and in that way, almost invisible. And the both of those deaths actually started as a kind of background brutality that characterizes the novel and in my observations, the region. And it was really only as I began, I guess, pushing myself to write whatever I found the most frightening to write, that I began to deal more and more directly with these deaths and with the people who were affected by these deaths and in some cases had participated in them. And that was a real sort of, I don't want to say challenge to myself because it makes it sound like an exercise, but more pushing myself to write into my own fear with the belief that that would yield on book with greater integrity. And I began to write, I suppose, into these deaths. The first time was actually just after the 2016 election, when Trump was elected. And I felt a profound agitation hearing about all the white women who had voted for Trump, white women like me. And I really wondered, you know, what is the difference between us? How many degrees of separation do we have? What is it? Is it just growing up in a household with more books or something? Like what made us different, me and these? And you know, I did not vote for Trump, and I'm quite far left on the political spectrum, but I'm aware that in terms of how we've benefited and aided the status quo, perhaps we're not that different. And I think it was that sort of agitation and horror that pushed me to write from the perspective of a young Jewish Israeli man who lived on a settlement and who had, in a kind of incidental and unplanned way, participated in this brutal mob attack, a kind of randomly selected revenge target for Yael's murder, a young Palestinian man in a mall parking lot who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, as they say. But I'd never gotten so close in my writing to ideological violence, to participating in it. And it's not as challenging, I would say, to write maybe violence. Writing violence is always challenging, but if the narrator is not participating in it, or if the writing itself is somehow commenting on the horror of this event, then at least you don't feel too at odds as the writer with what the narrator is saying or describing. You're sort of on the same page. You're on the same side that violence is bad, essentially. However, when you're writing a character who perhaps felt that this violence was ideologically justified or enjoyed it or was excited by it, then suddenly you're in a position where the writing isn't commenting. The writing itself, sentence to sentence, isn't providing a moral judgment. And so that sort of safety was taken away from me as the writer. And there became a kind of messy blurriness between me, the writer, and the narrator who was remembering being an actor in this violence. And that was terrifying, I have to say. And how strange to spend, you know, my morning writing that. I was in grad school at the time, an MFA in creative writing, or in fiction writing, I should say, at UC Irvine. And then to emerge from my little dorm room bedroom and talk to my roommate about like whether or not we were going to buy a toaster oven. It was so strange and unsettling, but I think worth it, because in the same way that I felt the boundary between me and this young man blur, and that the writing itself wasn't providing me with an out by expressing some kind of horror or outrage, I think that effect translates to a reader who, I think, in reading that chapter, Salam Abu something, finds themselves implicated, that the writing itself isn't saying this a horrible thing happened, but is rather forcing the reader to contend with providing, I guess, the judgment and the moral engine, because the young man who's telling us about it doesn't feel bad at all. So I think those were the scariest and most intense chapters to write, but I also think that they pull the reader in, and by pull them in, I guess I mean implicate or almost force the hand of the reader in a way that to me felt critical.
Well, absolutely. And as one of those readers, I can tell you, you succeeded with that. I mean, you're referring to, I believe, Meir. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rebecca Sachs about her novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It follows the lives of a large cast of characters, Israelis and Palestinians, after the murders of two young teenagers, one Israeli, the other Palestinian. And what's interesting is that Meir himself, the fact that he was involved, he skirts around it and circles around it. Then he goes back to something else, and then he circles back around to that. And it's that process of, you know, approach avoidance, I think, that pulls the reader in even more and has you questioning, like, where is he at? Where's this character at? And therefore, where am I at? And then it becomes more clear. He's an elite athlete on a team, and there is another player on the team who's an Arab, Shibi. And before we talk about Shibi, just to continue with Meir for a moment, I found so interesting that he had a kind of fascination with Shibi. You know, and I wrote in my notes, the fascination with and brutality toward the people you are oppressing.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt there must be some, I guess, psychological works written on this or psychoanalytical, and I wish I had them handy, but the interplay between fascination and disgust are so alive to me all over this novel, and certainly very much in the way that Meir looks at Palestinians. And there's a kind of a fascination and a disgust, and sometimes one disguised as the other. And I think for me that felt to echo in the attitude maybe Israeli culture has towards Palestinian culture and the Arab world more generally. And this is echoed in everything from the disenfranchisement of Jews from the Arab world historically in Israel, Mizrahi Jews, and also the kind of articulation of Israeli culture, how often that is, it's hard to find the right word. I want to say borrowed from Palestinian culture, but you could also say appropriated, or you could say overlapped. It's every word you choose, of course, is reveals your ideology and your politics and whose narrative you're echoing. But at any rate, I found some of those larger dynamics, cultural dynamics between Israel and Palestine, kind of concentrated and literalized in the character of this young man, Meir. But yes, he's obsessed with Shibi a little. And it's hard not to feel that somehow animated his feelings towards the violence towards this unrelated young Palestinian boy. It's a relief, I suppose, that I, the writer, don't need to be able to offer perhaps a full psychological account for the character. I think of myself as someone who kind of specializes in consequences, but not diagnoses on the level of psychology and the level of, you know, politics. I am obsessed with depicting the consequences of a boundary or an obsession, but I needn't be able to provide a full account of the obsession itself, which is great because I'm not fit to.
That's exactly what fiction does. I mean, you don't have to supply an account, you supply a character. And also, you don't shy away from very clear depiction. I mean, I have to say, to read this novel, Rebecca Sachs, City of a Thousand Gates, was for me to confront in such vivid detail the dehumanization of both peoples by the brutality of the Israeli state and society and increasing brutality thereof. I just wonder, as a Jewish person yourself, how was that for you?
Well, it's been a trying process, I have to say. I moved to Israel in 2012, actually without very strong opinions about Israel. I went to do a Jewish studies master's, and I thought of myself as a sort of neutral, uninflected party, which is ridiculous, but that is how I imagined myself. And I think as I lived there, I was simultaneously becoming very attached to the Jewish state and to the belonging it afforded me and to the incredible warmth and hospitality with which I was received. And also feelings of deep horror at what it cost. What are the consequences of an ethnic democracy? And maybe forcing myself to witness them and articulating them to myself. So I sort of cultivated, I think, a sense of belonging and a sense of alienation simultaneously. Living in Israel made me a writer. It gave me a world of boundaries that were waiting to be depicted and tested in narrative. And it made me a Jew. You know, I grew up in a Reform household, but my mother wasn't born Jewish and never formally converted. And it was really only living in Israel and being sort of part of the rhythms of Jewish life that I ultimately decided to formally convert and embrace my Jewish identity. So Israel has given me so much, I have to say, and connected me to such profound parts of myself. And yet, at the same time, the consequences, again, this word consequences, but the consequences of preserving an ethnic democracy are horrific. And they are horrific for both the Palestinians who are subjugated and for the Israelis who are put into the role of oppressor. These consequences are not symmetrical in the least, one of the great narrative lies told again and again and again about the conflict is that it's somehow symmetrical. There's these two sides, these two ancient foes. And it's so obscene to present it that way when there is a staggering imbalance in power and money, and all of this is very much tied to legacies of colonialism and imperialism. So to reiterate, the consequences are not symmetrical or equivalent, but they are very real for both peoples. And in writing this, I tried to push myself to think deeply about what each character loves and what each character is giving up. And I think for me, this felt, if not truer, more heartfelt than perhaps a discussion of ideology or even politics explicitly. None of the characters are real political actors, but everyone has had their daily life shaped by the politics of the world they live in.
You have a character, Rebecca Sachs, in City of a Thousand Gates, Emily, who's an American. In fact, I saw two characters in which I thought I could discern the author of the book. It's Emily and also Vera, who's a journalist. But Emily, at one point, she goes on a visit, I think it is to the West Bank, you know, a kind of, this is a tour by an American Jewish man who is in sympathy with the Palestinian cause to show American Jews what it's like over there. And her voice comes through here. She says, you know, surely they, meaning people like her, are different than the wild-haired extremists who set fire to Palestinian schools, who take and take and take. That's not them. No, not them. Not them. No. And was that your voice coming in there? I mean, how do you deal with, you know, it's so palpably in this book, one sees, you know, the taking of land and the blowing up of houses, the retribution, the denial of water in a time of climate change. It's just unending, the humiliations.
Yes, the characters of as you've noted, of Emily and Vera, who are the two white women in the novel, and so absolutely contain some elements of self-critique in them. There's no way around it. I don't know how much we share personally beyond our positionalities, but absolutely, that's an element. And yes, I mean, I think in that moment that you quoted, and I'm really glad you read that part aloud. Thank you. Where Emily is trying to convince herself that she's not a settler. She's different. She's different from settlers, from what Israelis call settlers. Most Palestinians, when they say settlers, they mean anyone who lives in Israel, not specifically individuals who live in, you know, parts of the West Bank where the UN considers the settlements illegal. These almost like academic distinctions that liberal Israelis and liberal Jews make between who's a settler and who's not are really for our own benefit and don't really have anything to do, as far as I can tell, with the discussions happening amongst Palestinians. But meaning for our benefit, I mean, to make us feel better, to draw these distinctions between extreme right politics and liberal politics. But of course, so often liberal politics are just right-wing politics apologetically or with more euphemism involved. So I would say that moment was, it's not a very ironic book. I don't traffic in a lot of irony, but I think that moment became maybe a little ironic. I really had Emily sort of protesting, oh no, not us. No, no, no. Which is a great way to signal to a reader like, hey, this person might be in a little bit of denial. You should, you should think critically about what this person is saying here. And so, I think I was interrogating more than anything, my own desire to distinguish myself. This, you know, Jewish American Canadian woman who had come to Israel, who had taken citizenship, and yet, you know, I wanted to feel that I was different from the hardliner settlers, that I wasn't a settler, that I was on in the parlance of our times, the right side of history. And I think denying myself the satisfaction of being one of the good guys was really important, and to recognize the ways in which these distinctions between who's a settler and who isn't a settler so often is, as I said, for the benefit of the ruling class, but really has very little to do with the lived reality of the individuals being subjugated. And so, yes, you're right to pick at that moment as a moment in which I think Emily and I share something, to go back to that, you know, what do I share with the character? We share something, and I did not want to shy away from it in that moment.
Yeah, and we only have a few minutes left, but I don't want to leave without exploring another very revealing part, because I think, you know, in this novel, you're not only getting into the minds of both Palestinians and Israelis, but also the minds of the rest of the world, and or the Western world in particular, and how we look upon the conflict. So there's an explosion in the novel, and we don't really know if the explosion is intentional or if it's an accident, but one of the characters takes a photo that they post to Instagram that goes to every screen on the planet. This photo comes to be known as the Palestinian girl and the Israeli soldier. Talk about that photo and, you know, what part that plays in this book. What are you showing us with that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think the narratives that emerge about the conflict, about Palestine and Israel, especially from the West, I think these narratives so often, as I mentioned closer to the beginning of our conversation, so often traffic in this lie of symmetry. And I wanted to find a way to illustrate this lie, essentially, the narrative lie of a symmetrical conflict, as a way to show the kind of addiction that the West has to resolution and to hope, and how this desire to see that... that need for resolution and hope gratified so often erases the individuals inside those moments and the deeply asymmetrical realities of these two people, of this young Israeli soldier and this young Palestinian student. And I hoped that in a way, I don't know, I wasn't thinking of this at the time, but I guess my hope would be that in a way it might, reading through this news story and the reader of the novel being privy to the realities of the lives of the characters in this news story might also, I don't know, I guess my hope would be perhaps lend itself to a little more criticism or awareness of how stories from Palestine and Israel are packaged.
Well, I wish we had longer to talk about this absolutely stunning novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It's so powerful. It's also so beautifully written. Thank you so much, Rebecca Sacks, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's been my honor. Thank you very much.
That was Rebecca Sacks talking with Writer's Voice in February of 2021. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.